Good morning, Ali Ram speaking.
Hi, Ali. Bill Hogue, how are you this morning?
Hi, I'm doing just fine.
I appreciate you joining us. Generally, what we've started out with is asking that you spend a few minutes talking about how you got to be where you are. So if you could talk a little bit about how you got started and how you progressed to the point of being a CIO at a major research institution, that would be a good way to get us rolling.
I actually got started in IT in the early 60s, and actually it was in 1960 when I went into the military. And IT at that time was quite different. And basically what I did there was I wired accounting machines. And so in those days, that's how you programmed computers. While there were very large computers, most of the technology that was used in corporations and universities consisted of, in terms of business functions, consisted of wiring accounting machines to do various things and punch cards and what have you. So that's really how I got my start in IT. And then when I came out of the military, I went to work for Loyola University, and my first job there was, you know, wiring accounting machines. And we finally got a 1401 computer, and I started programming that and ended up writing programs that did things like registration and records and things of that sort, student information primarily.
And, Ali, when you say Loyola, which Loyola are you referring to?
Loyola University of Chicago.
Of Chicago, okay.
Yes.
And for those who don't have personal experience of that era in computing, could you describe very briefly what wiring a computer meant? I've certainly experienced it myself, but there are some who probably haven't.
Yeah, well, what it meant was actually connecting circuits in a board, and that's really how you program the computer, you know, by putting wires in panels and connecting circuits. And there were some computers that you connected circuits in that actually allowed you to print reports and do calculations. And there were some computers that you wired that allowed you to merge cards. And it actually would merge cards. I think they were called correlators, if you recall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it meant. It was very, very limited in terms of what you could do. And in fact, there would be some problems that you simply could not solve because it just couldn't be done because of the limitations of the hardware.
But you progressed from there into, at that time, state-of-the-art IBM architecture and made the migration to actually programming those computers rather than moving physical wires.
Yes. And I became what was called an autocoder programmer. And then I moved there from there into assembly language programming, and from there into COBOL programming. And basically, I really cut my teeth on implementing systems on mainframe computers, writing programs in assembly language and COBOL. I ended up leaving Loyola and went to work for Arthur Andersen and Company. And there I participated in centralizing all of the systems in Chicago for Arthur Andersen. You know, that is to run the corporation. And one of my major systems was a payroll system, because one of the systems I wrote at Loyola was a payroll system. I ended up writing one of the key modules for a payroll system that consolidated all of the calculations for the payroll, and it involved state taxes for about 35 different states. And so that I spent some time there. Then I went to the City Colleges of Chicago. And this is where I started to move into management. I was hired there as a systems manager. My job actually was to design systems, work with users, and what have you. And then after that, the director left. After I was there about 2 years, he left and took another job. And then the chancellor at that time appointed me as the director of data processing.
And what year was this, Eileen?
This was in 1970, because I was, I'm going to tell my age here, because I was 28 years old at the time when I got my first DP manager's job.
So you've been in management roles for going on 36 years at this point.
Yes, that's exactly right. I stayed at Loyola the City Colleges of Chicago for some time, and then I held various other positions. And I ended up at Heller Financial Corporation, where I was associate assistant vice president for methods and operations. Now, what that meant was that I actually provided support for the marketing people who, very early on, on, we figured out that we could actually leverage the technology to actually in the sales part of the operation to actually allow the salespeople to be a lot more effective. And so I actually worked with the marketing people. We had marketing people, for example, selling things like equipment finance. They actually use part of the technology that we offered. You know, that is, we allowed people to go online and actually do modeling and what have you in terms of particular sales or particular products. And so I did that for about 3 years. Then I ended up I set up a data center in Chicago for three different universities, for the State of Illinois Board of Governors. And we provided data center support. We consolidated all the technology into one data center for Chicago State, Governor State University, and Northeastern Illinois University. And that turned out to be pretty successful. In fact, that they went on for at least 20 years before they actually decided to break it up and have each university have their own data center. But in the process, I worked with an individual who came back to Ohio, and he was the director of computer services for Miami University of Ohio. He called me one day while I was at Heller Financial and said that he was looking for a successor because he was thinking about retiring in a few years. And so that's how I ended up at Miami University of Ohio as the data processing person. Ultimately, they didn't have a CIO at that point, but I was in charge of IT at Miami. And because of my finance background at Heller Financial, the guy who was the associate vice president for business and finance went to Kent State University, and I went there as the associate vice president for business and finance after he took his job. After he was there, and I followed him in about a year. And IT was one of the areas that I had responsibility for. But I also had responsibility for things like the airport, the purchasing department, and really the entire business services function. And he left, incidentally. And after he left, the president asked me to become the vice president for business and finance. And so I actually did that for a couple of years, and then I had to make a decision because my career was somewhat at a crossroads. You know, that is, do I continue with the business and finance route, or do I actually continue and become CIO? Because during that two-year period, I was in essence the CFO and CIO at the same time. So what happened then was I decided to stay the CIO route, obviously. Went to Chicago as the vice chancellor and CIO for the City Colleges of Chicago. Remember, I worked for them before. And while sitting at my desk, I got a call from the executive placement firm that was looking for a CIO for Ohio State, and actually tried to help them find somebody for a couple of months because I really didn't want to move back to Ohio. But I changed my mind with my wife's advice, and I've been here for the last 6.5 years. So that's how I ended up at Ohio State, that is, at this R1 institution. I worked at Miami and Ohio for 5 years, Kent State University for 6.5 years. And I will have to say that Ohio State was always the one institution that I was intrigued by.
Why is that?
Well, because it was the largest institution in the state. It was an R1 institution. Looking on the outside, Ohio State always seemed to have more resources than any of the other institutions. And I thought it would be interesting to work for an institution where you had resources. And also, it also had a level of prestige that the other institutions didn't have, with the potential exception at the undergraduate level of, you know, Miami was a prestigious institution. But it was for all of these reasons.
A question that comes to mind after your last comment is, now that you've been on the other side of the desk, so to speak, at Ohio State for 6+ years, how does it compare with what you imagined it might be like when you were working at Kent State and or Kent University and Miami University?
I think this is the best job I've had. But back to your original question, though, and that is, how did it match up against my expectations? I think I was a little bit surprised by the complexity because I knew how large the institution was, but when I actually took the job, You know, having to deal with 19 colleges and four regional campuses was a bit more complex than I could have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did find was that at a large R1 institution, what you really have is an enormous amount of autonomy, because the institution is so large, everyone's so engaged that basically, and if you have a high-level position like I have, you really have to go and do your job. You know, and then you have to sell your vision, and then you have to implement your vision.
And if you reflect back on your career, one of the things that I immediately observe is that your career trajectory is unusual compared to a lot of CIOs, if only because you moved in and out of the private sector several times.
Yes.
And I wonder, since that is fairly unique, I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the pros and cons of moving back and forth from higher education to the business sector and what it has taught you, any advice that you have about additional preparation that it may have helped you to gain for meeting the challenges that you have in your current opportunity, that sort of thing.
That's a really good question, and it can cut both ways. And by that I mean this. When I'm talking to board members, and then I'll talk a little bit more about my private sector background, but when I talk to board members, for example, who are, for the most part, you know, private sector people, you know, they run corporations, it gives me some added credibility when I can talk about some of the things we did at Arthur Andersen, or when I worked at Heller Financial, or when I actually ran, I didn't mention this, I actually ran a consulting firm in Chicago, technology consulting firm, for 6 years. That gives me some added credibility, and because they feel that I perhaps have a better understanding of what it takes to run a large organization, and they think it gives me an added sensitivity to running an operation more efficiently. Now, the other side of that also is that I don't push that with my academic counterparts, my academic folk, because they may see it as a negative.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a lot of academic background, and I built my reputation in the academic community by being known as one who supports the use of computers by faculty, the use of technology by faculty. At Kent State University, one of the things that I did was I reallocated resources to provide more support, you know, for faculty from the administrative side, you know, which was a real difficult thing to do, but in the end, it really created a much stronger organization. And I did the same thing at Ohio State. I've shifted resources that were used or identified as administrative resources into the e-learning area or distance education. You know, so that even though I have the private sector background, you know, I do have a reputation for being quite supportive and quite understanding of faculty needs, and I have a lot of faculty supporters at Ohio State here, and I also have a great relationship with the deans.
Ellie, let me go back on something you said before when you talked about the fact that Ohio State had stood out as a place that was intriguing to you, you might want to work. How have you found your experience at a larger school like that in terms of just the balance between challenge and reward? You know, we all try to find that balance of school where we want to be, that where we get the greatest sense of fulfillment. How has that worked out for you in Ohio State versus the other schools where you've worked?
I think that the challenges have been many. We've had a number of things that we had to do. For example, we needed a strategic plan when I started, because we needed to at least have that discussion around campus so that we could basically have some consensus on how we should allocate the resources as we move forward. And that's what a technology strategic plan would do for you. It would give you some consensus on how to allocate your resources. But in addition, having the discussion tends to get people thinking more or less along the same page. And so we were able to get that done. And so that was a major challenge. One of the other challenges was to change the culture of the organization. And that's really difficult in a large organization. And so one of the things I did there was I came in talking about values and beliefs. And because I think if you change the values, you finally get people to buy into the new culture if they buy into the values. And we preached about values such as integrity, you know, such as operating in a dignified and respectful way and treating people with dignity and respect. And not only am I talking about users, but also those that we work with. And so we do that. At the same time, we emphasize accountability. You know, that is, if you do something, then you say what you do and do what you say. And if you don't, you know, stand up and be accountable for it. And so we put in project management, formalized project management procedures in order to emphasize that, and that has worked out very well. What happens, though, in an environment like this is you can't expect to be, you can't expect a pat on the head and a reward on a daily basis. I think it comes over time. I think it took probably a year or two before most of the people around campus were convinced that I knew what I was talking about. You know, but now I've got but over time you develop a large core of support, you know, and you do get those moments of rewards that may be in front of the board, for example, you know, where the board chairman would make a positive comment. The president in cabinet, you know, will make a positive, you know, you get it in front of the president and the cabinet, I should say. I report directly to the provost and executive vice president, and she readily acknowledges, you know, my contributions. But probably what happened most importantly there in terms of acknowledgement is the fact that last November, my 5-year contract was up. You know, I signed I came up with a 5-year agreement. Well, it was renewed for another 5 years after an extensive review process, which included feedback from folks all over this campus as well as all of the deans. So an interesting process to go through. But in the end, the fact that people feel as though they want you for another 5 years, I think, is a tremendous acknowledgement.
Eileen, one of the other questions that we frequently pursue is, I think, something that you've already touched upon. You said you came to a career crossroads when, in essence, you were serving as both the CFO and a CIO in one of your roles.
Yes.
And you had to decide which way you were going to go.
Yes.
What did you weigh, and what ultimately pushed you toward the path that you've chosen?
I think when I looked at the two paths, I also thought about my background. Most of my background up to that point had been in the IT area, and I really got a lot of fulfillment out of this particular area, primarily because of all of the change occurring in technology, and I just could not see giving that up because it really takes a lot to keep up in this field, and I was starting to lose touch anyway after those 2 years, and so I just thought that was more consistent with what I wanted to do. I love the change aspect of it. The pace is quicker. It's just a much more challenging, I think, management environment, although some CFOs, I'm sure, would disagree with me.
They wouldn't be CFOs if they didn't.
that's right. But I think that's what it was, because most of my background was in IT. I thought that I really wanted to stay in IT, and I don't regret my decision at all.
One of the big things that is being talked about a great deal in EDUCAUSE and elsewhere in higher education right now is the whole topic of mentoring. Whether you think about mentoring as a formal process or as an informal or less formal process, as you look back on your career, have you had significant mentors along the way? And if so, could you talk about them a little bit?
You know, yeah, I have, but they were probably more informal. Maybe the one person that had the most influence on me was the person who was the DP manager when I went to Loyola University. And this was 1963 when I joined Loyola University in Chicago. And he was data processing manager there, and he happened to be African American and male. Well, he obviously is male, but he was an African American. And he was a very interesting guy because of how well-read he was, and how, particularly in the area of management and just in general, and he was involved with the Toastmasters there as well. He was also a very good in written communications. So he had a tremendous influence on me, because also he was demanding, He believed in accountability. And I think that was one of the best things that could have happened to me at the time. You know, a young kid, you know, fresh out of the military. The military obviously had a great influence on me as well because of the thing that the military does, I think, better than anything else is it makes you accountable. You have a strong sense of accountability and a strong sense of responsibility and follow through. You know, so that helped. So this guy, Garland Frazier was his name, was a great influence on me. The next person that I probably, that probably had the best influence on me was, remember when I told you that I ended up coming to Ohio because I got a call from a friend who was at Miami University in Ohio?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I worked with him at the State of Illinois Board of Governors, a cooperative computer center. And he was very good at sharing his management philosophy and also to discussing why he did certain things. And we would sit for a couple of hours quite frequently after work just talking about what was going on and why he did certain things. And he was really a tremendous, I think, influence on me. His name was Dick Newman. Dick really taught me a lot about patience and not acting too quickly when you didn't have to act, and really that not making a decision at a particular time was actually a course of action as well. You didn't have to make a decision. And you didn't have to answer every question that somebody asked you in the meeting. You know, it was okay to say, I don't necessarily know that, but have the answer right now, but I can get back to you.
What about persons for whom you have served as a mentor? Can you tell us about those experiences? And also, what are the things that you look for in individuals that you believe make them emerging leaders worthy of making kind of that extra investment in, that they have that something special? What kinds of experiences have you had, and what is it that tells you that they have that something special?
It's intelligence, but it's also, it's more than that. It's the ability to follow through and to the willingness to follow through on getting the job done. There are people who actually view their position descriptions as a minimum and are not afraid to operate outside of their particular job. They are people who possess integrity, who when they give you when they say something you can believe that they're honest about what they're saying. They're not people who don't have hidden agendas, but people who are committed to advancing a better in the organization. I look for people who really are looking to do what's best for the organization and who are also interested in doing as much and learning as much as they can about the particular organization or university, who really are interested in that.
Do you seek those people out? Do you have those people identified that you have that kind of a special mentor relationship with?
I do seek them out in the organization. I know at Kent State University, I know that one of the gentlemen there was in the area of operations. He possessed all the qualities that I talked about earlier, and I actually promoted him to become director of information technology. Then he went on to become executive director for the area, and now he's CIO at Bowling Green. And that's been, you know, great to see. In fact, when I see him, I jokingly say, you know, whenever I see you, Bruce, I feel like a proud father. And there are people at Ohio State that I'm working with now, one person in particular, you know, that I'm working with.
Eileen, just to go back to an earlier point that you raised, you said your very first mentor was an African-American male.
Right.
That was even rarer at that time, if I may say so, than it is now. As our nation's population becomes more heterogeneous and as there are more opportunities and more diversity in leadership positions in higher education, do you have particular advice for people who are either on the basis of gender or race or ethnicity currently underrepresented and who perhaps don't have as many role models or potential mentors who have particular understanding of the circumstances that they face in advancing their careers? Do you have any particular advice for folks who are in that kind of a situation?
Yeah, I guess I do, and actually I just spoke recently to the BDPA group in the Columbus area as a part of Black History Month. But I'm not so sure if they don't apply to everybody. Now, there are a couple that I will underscore, but I think they apply to anybody, no matter if you're a minority or if you're a woman. And really, one of them is, as I mentioned earlier, it's know your company, your business, and your industry. You know, really, that's really, really important. And also, treat your position description as a minimum. And also, don't let anyone outwork you. And sometimes that I get a reaction when I say that. You know, that's the one thing that you have control of. I know that in sports, you know, we talk about defense as the thing that you can, that's a constant. You can always play great defense, but I think you can always work hard. You know, so I think it's inexcusable to let somebody outwork you. And so I think it's be willing to work hard. The other one that may apply to minorities or women more so is don't hesitate to participate in business social functions and participate. Don't say, well, I really don't want to go. I feel uncomfortable. I shouldn't say don't say that, but even if you feel uncomfortable about it, you know, go ahead and do it anyway. You know, force yourself. And you may even find out that you can go and have a great time and at the same time develop better connections with people. Because the reality is a lot of positions are people moving to positions based on their particular social connections or because people feel comfortable with working, you know, with them. Although perhaps I should have phrased it that way. The other thing is I think people should always engage in individual continuous improvement. And that is, you know, always be on the lookout for learning new things. You know, read as much as you can about your area and about your profession. If you want to become a manager, you know, read a lot of management books. I know that I was almost obsessed with reading everything that Peter Drucker wrote at one point in my career. So I think that's particularly important. The other thing is if you're in your organization, identify who the key decision influencers are and get to know these people, because if you look at an org chart, you may think it's clear who the decision makers are, I should say. But what is usually behind the scenes are some decision influencers who are whispering in the ears of the decision makers who are too busy really to be involved with that much of the details. So they're listening to other people. So find out who those people are, and at some point, you may even become one yourself. And that's one of, I think, the best ways to rise, to move up, is if you become a key decision influencer to a key decision maker in your organization. And the other one is communicate, you know, verbal and written, you know, no surprises. You know, that is, don't surprise your manager. Make sure you do whatever you can to keep your manager up to date. And the other thing is, don't present problems without solutions. That is, if you walk into your manager with a problem, make sure that you have in mind some alternatives. You know, don't walk into your manager and say, here's a problem, what should I do next? But do go in and say, here's an issue that we're facing, and here are some alternatives that I think we should consider to resolve that. Probably the other one would be to understand that it is just as important to be respected as liked. And in some cases, if you had to choose between being liked and respected, I think you probably want to be respected, because being respected is probably going to get you a promotion, a moved up quicker than being liked.
If you could take one thing, let's just hypothetically, if someone is coming into your office as you're leaving, you've never talked to this person before, and it's a person that, you know, in a hypothetical world is going to replace you. You've grown an organization, and you want to see it pass to good hands. And you can, in passing this person, only tell them, they ask you, what's the one thing that I absolutely have to remember? Can you think of either, you know, pick out from the things you've talked about or from things that you haven't, just the one thing that you would say to that person, whatever you do, don't forget this?
Can I give you multiple things?
Sure.
One is clarity in communication to the staff. I think that you really have to communicate to the staff, you know, about what's going on, so they can clearly understand what their role and position is in all of the many projects that are going on. One of the things that we do is we produce a status report monthly, and that was one of the things I did. Is I actually have a status report that I actually. And maybe it's really a report, a monthly report that goes to the provost and the senior vice president for finance, and I think that the president also sees it. And it's a summary report. It's no longer than 5 or 6 pages, but it summarizes all of the things that are going on in the organization. What we also do with that report is we take a version of it, and we post it out, and every staff member can look at it. And they get to see what's going on in the whole organization. A lot of them get to see projects that they're working on reflected in the report. So communication to the staff and to the leadership is extremely important. So I think so don't forget to communicate upward and also downward and crossways within the staff. So communication, I think, is really the important thing. The other thing that I would advise one not to forget is never lose the strong sense of accountability that's going to be required, because that's really how you improve. And by accountability, I don't mean that you beat people up whenever they do something, you know, wrong, or that you go out of your way to put them on the spot. But what you do is you let people know that it is important to, you know, to be responsive, to get things done on time. And one of the things that we do is we do a survey. Maybe this is really the response to the question. Don't forget to systematically survey your user population as well as your staff and to get their feedback so that you know what things you need to work on a continuing basis, you know, what things you need to improve on. And we do these surveys annually, and we have actually an outside group that actually does a survey for us. And I take we break down these surveys, and we give the results to the various people on the staff and the managers on the staff. So, look, these are the areas that we need to make some improvements on based on what we see on the survey. And the next year we can look at the survey again, and we can determine if we've actually made any progress. And people are your most important resource. I think that's the other thing, that maybe that's the obvious. You know, don't forget that people are your most important resource, and that you should cultivate them. You should provide professional development opportunities for your staff, and don't worry about training people and have them leave you, because the worst thing is to not train people and have them stay. You know, so I think that's also something that I would emphasize.
Finally, anybody who's been a CIO for more than about a week has to find a way to cope with disappointments or frustrations or navigating turbulent waters.
Yes.
That's just part of the job.
Yes.
And I think that sometimes when we are looking at these jobs from the outside, when we haven't sat in a CIO seat, we're not often quite as aware of how many issues, some going well, some going not as well, have to be juggled simultaneously. Any advice that you might offer on maintaining balance, staying resilient in the face of turbulent waters, and continuing to march forward toward objectives?
Yeah, I think that you have to, first of all, expect it, you know, that it's turbulence. For the staff, what you have to be is a steadying influence. You know, what you have to be careful about is getting the staff too energized by some of the turbulence. And you have to, in some cases, maybe not become as excited as you actually are internally, you know, with the staff, because you have to be the steadying influence. I think that when you face those turbulence or when you're dealing with very difficult situations, one of the first things you have to do is whichever group you're dealing with, is you have to see if you can agree on a set of principles that will allow you to have objective discussions, you know, that is without getting overly emotional. And I think if you can take as much of the emotion out as you can, then I think you can reach some agreements. You know, I've had a number of those where in the beginning it seemed like it was going to be a really difficult situation. And basically by agreeing to a set of principles, we were able to actually resolve this.
Are there personal habits or activities that you engage in to take your mind off and restore your energy at a personal level to find that balance so that you can come in and maintain that calm demeanor when you're faced with that kind of situation?
When I'm away, I'm really I have the ability to be away, you know, when I'm away from the office, when I'm on vacation. Now, at the same time, what that doesn't mean is that I don't do email when I'm on vacation, because I do. But I pick and choose what I respond to. My wife and I communicate very well, and she incidentally has a PhD in higher education leadership. And so I'll go home and we'll talk about things. And I think that helps as well. I'm a big sports enthusiast, you know, that helps take my mind off of things. But the other thing, you know, that I have is I have a great relationship with the various deans and other vice presidents around the university. You know, I've cultivated those relationships, and we go out to lunch together. You know, they don't hesitate picking up the phone and calling me. So it's unusual now for me to have a real crisis, because what typically happens is somebody will call me very early in the process and say that, you know, we need to discuss this, and we'll discuss it. And the communication lines are open between me and the other executives at the institution. And I think that's extremely important if you're going to be effective and if you're going to be able to maintain any sort of calm demeanor.
Earlier you talked about your habit at various times in your career of almost obsessively reading materials related to management. You cited Peter Drucker.
Yes.
Are there other sources of reading, either books or particular authors, websites, periodicals, any kind of media that you tap into on a regular basis that you found useful to you and others may find the same?
I do read not as much as I used to, the EDUCAUSE journals. I think one of the more recent management books I've read is First Break All the Rules. I had a chance to hear him speak. And whenever I can hear some top-notch business leaders or educational leaders speak, you know, I go and hear them. For example, the previous chairman for GE.
Jack Welch.
Jack Welch. I had a chance to hear Jack Welch, talk. That was very interesting to hear him, you know, talk about his management philosophy. I also went to and graduated from the Nkubo Leadership Institute. They used to have an institute that you went through, and you had to go through two rounds of it, actually two sessions, before you graduated, and I went through that.
Ali, you know, you talked about maintaining your composure. You didn't put it that way, but I think it, you know, that kind of a calming effect with your staff in turbulent waters.
Yes.
Well, let me turn that around and ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, leadership is situational. Sometimes the higher level Peter Drucker, Stephen Covey kinds of principle-centered leadership work fine in a more mature organization. But when you are in an organization that is not mature, that you're having to do some pretty significant re-engineering to, you know, you've got bad sorts of things entrenched in the culture. When and how, to use it a sports analogy, do you take the intentional technical foul to get your point across?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Incidentally, I forgot about situational leadership has been one of my favorites. Hershey Blanchard, you know, involved with that, and I've done a lot of reading on that. In fact, I've conducted sessions with staff members on situational leadership since I've been here to get them to better understand, you know, why you should view management from a situational leadership perspective. There are times when you need to be excited. You need to let people know that you're excited and that you're not happy. You know, and I think one of the best ways to do this is just say it. You know, I'm not happy. You know, you don't have to yell and scream when you say it, but if you say it with the right tone, people get it and they understand what you're talking about. But I think more importantly, what you have to do is you have to be willing to follow up. If somebody is displaying inappropriate behavior, then I think what you have to do is you have to let them know that that's inappropriate. And you have to let staff know that you're going to respond in that way. And I'm willing to do that. And I think that's an important part of being of leadership. You're right. Because otherwise, it's hard to change anything. You know, but I think you have to be clear in terms of your direction. You have to be clear in terms of what values and beliefs that you espouse for the organization. You have to be clear in terms of how you expect the staff to deal with customers. You have to be clear in terms of this whole issue of integrity. I know I've had people say to me, you know, Ali, what do you think we should tell the users? And my point has always been, tell them the truth. just tell them exactly, you know, the way that it is, and then we'll be accountable.
Eileen, as we come to the close of our hour, are there things that you would wish to talk about that we haven't questioned you on, that things that you may have reflected on prior to our conversation this morning?
I think you've been fairly thorough. You know, I think that there are many paths that one could take to become CIO. I think that whichever path that one takes, I think one of the most important things is to establish and maintain a reputation for excellence. That embodies doing a lot of things, but the bottom line is that you focus on doing everything you can to deliver a quality product and to do a quality job. And I think that that's really important. It does not mean that you take forever to do what you're doing, because at some point you have to deliver, you know, but one should establish and maintain a reputation, you know, for excellence and for having integrity and for being willing to be accountable.
Very good. Well, I greatly appreciate your time this morning.
Okay, thank you. And I hope that this in some small way adds to what you're doing.
Yeah, Eileen, let me second what Bill said. It has been a true pleasure to talk to you this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and have a great week.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.